Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. And we have the first ever live on-the-show guest, Don McAllister from Screencast Online.
Hello, Allison. It's great to be here.
Yay. You're going to have to lean in even more, okay. I think, so right. I can see the signal there. So we're actually doing the show live on Ustream. We're snuggled up here close enough to be able to be seen on the camera together. Share a mic. We have had such a great weekend. Steve and I were allowed to guest Don at the house here and then go over to Catalina Island for a special screening of the new Star Trek movie over on Catalina as guests of Gene Roddenberry. Yeah. I'm sorry, not Gene Roddenberry. No. Rod Roddenberry, whose name is actually Eugene.
That's right, that's right. So you're coaster with it. Yeah. We just got back and we've had a really good time. It's been quite a weekend, hasn't it, really?
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of fun. Uh-huh. We had a really good time. So we played around. Don waxed my car today.
I did, yes. Just a small part, though, I must admit.
Enough for a good photograph, right? That was the main part. But we had a great time. Went over to Catalina Island and played around. We sat out in the sun. Yep. Might have had a couple of beers. A
couple of beers, some good food, some fast food, more fast food.
No, the best meal you had in the whole time, of course, was...
That was probably the In-N-Out burger, I think.
No. Taco Bell Thursday.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I've got the burrito.
Yes.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. No, it was really nice. It was most enjoyable, especially with a hot sauce.
Yeah, see, he's no weenie Englishman not liking hot food. I was very surprised you liked that.
No, it was good.
But we did get to go see the movie, and I will not do any spoilers. Don't worry. People in the chat room, BJ's really concerned I'm going to do a spoiler, but of course I never would. The best thing I can say about it is it was Star Trek.
Yeah, it was great. They did a fantastic job. I was really impressed with it. I mean, we'd heard all the reviews, and everyone had been raving about it, but I think they were pretty much on the money, really. It was great.
Yeah, we had a great time. We had a really good time. So anyway... one of the highlights of the weekend was that we got to sit and chat with Rod himself. He was gracious enough to do an interview with me. We talked about a half hour about Macintoshes, and then, let's see, the documentary he's doing about his father and his passion for diving. It was really an honor to talk to him and a great thrill for me when he told me he listens to the show. That was so cool because we stopped him in the street. We kind of badgered him in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
And he said, wow, it's weird to actually hear your voice and see you talking at the same time. And I had no idea he was a listener. So that was really fun. We had a great time. So anyway, I'll be releasing that interview as a standalone show later this week. And I think you guys are going to really like it. All right, let's kick into the show here. We've got about over 150 entries for the anniversary giveaway for next weekend, all of whom have gotten in by the deadline, which was today. I had thought about letting stragglers come in later in the week, but you know what? I always resent it when people do that. Why be unfair to the people who got their homework done on time? So if you have not gotten your email in to me by now, don't bother because you're going to have to wait for the fifth year anniversary if you didn't do it yet. Next week's show should be really interesting. It's been created entirely by Steve. All I know is that he's created it by pulling together audio segments from the past 4 years' worth of shows. I'm really looking forward to it. Plus, I get a vacation next week. We're going to break up that entertainment with telling you about the winners of the contest. Now, I was worried I don't want to just sit there and read name after name and Bob won this and Sally won that. You know, they get really dull. So I'm going to try to find some way to make it not an endless dreary list of names and prizes. But I do want to tell you that people won the prizes. So it's going to be tough. But I think what I'm going to do is speed talk my way through it. I'll just go as fast as I can or something like that. I'll find some way to make it not boring for you. Anyway, it's going to be fun for me because it's going to be like playing Santa next week. Let's see. So remember last week when I read Gita's mail about the options to control Windows more creatively on the Mac? I said that I watched the screencast on Mercury Mover, and it scared me because so many keystrokes kept popping up on me on the screen, so I kind of moved on. I also said that I couldn't get through the arithmetic CAPTCHA on AtomicBird.com. It defeated me when I tried to write to them about asking about Mondo Mouse, which was another tool she had told me about. Well, I got an email from Keith Alperin of HeliumFoot.com, the people who make Mercury Mover, and I think you'll really enjoy what he wrote. Hi, Allison. Your latest episode of the NoSillaCast showed up on my radar, and I wanted to thank you for the mention and the link to Mercury Mover. Hopefully it'll be easier to use than my screencast seems to suggest. I'm taking your criticism of my screencast to heart, and I plan to redo it by the end of the next quarter. I'm a little overbooked right now, though. In the meantime, Don McAllister did a really great one for Screencast Online about 6 months ago, and he put a link into, let's see, it looks like show number 175. And let me read the rest of it, and I'll talk to Don for a second. He says, finally, I spoke to the proprietor of AtomicBird.com, and it looks like his CAPTCHA is 8 times 3, not 8 plus 3. Yeah. I was trying to do the CAPTCHA, and I couldn't get through it, and I kept saying it was 8 plus 3, and I kept putting in 11, and I kept saying I was confused by it. So anyway, he says, some problems are software, some are hardware, and some are eyewear. So seriously, it's a good thing that I said I was arithmetically challenged before we did it. And, you know, I really did get A's in calculus, I promise. I hope you believe me. But arithmetic is my kryptonite, I'm afraid. Totally embarrassing. Well, I owe it to Keith to give Mercury Mover a try now, don't you think, after how nice he was and everything. So, Don, talk to you a little bit. You did a screencast on this?
Yeah, it's an application that I use a lot, really, because it just helps you control your windows on your Mac using your keyboard. And it's especially important if I'm doing a screencast, because it's really important to have the screens in the same position for continuity. So if I do break off and I just move the screen slightly or the window slightly, it can actually disrupt, you know, it doesn't look right. So I use Mercury Mover. You can actually record positions of windows, and I use it to record set positions of windows, and then I can, if I do move a window around, I can easily get it back to where it was just by hitting a few keystrokes.
So all those keystrokes don't scare you?
No, not really. There's only it's very easy. I mean, the standard keystrokes are very easy to learn once you've used it for a certain while. It's only really, and the ones I use are the ones to move the window to the center of the screen or to the top corners. And there's ways of actually incrementally moving them down the screen as well. It's just really what you sort of get used to. But I like the fact that you can record your own screen positions and then save either just the size, save just the position, or save both the size and the position as well at the same time.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. I think I would like to be able to do that. So I'll give Mercury Mover a try. Maybe I'll watch your screencast first before I give it a try on my own.
That's right. It'll give you a good idea of what you can actually do with it. Yeah.
Don is the training wheels of learning, I think. Josh wrote in with some interesting counterpoints on a couple of the points I made in my G1 review. I want to read them to you, but I'm going to interrupt him often. Allison, first of all, I love the podcast, but I have a few issues with your Android review as I have a G1. Maybe try reading the manual. I know it's really hard, but... If you had, maybe you would have discovered the long press function and figured out how to delete email without opening it. Well, I wasn't actually given the manual, so in that case, I can use that as an excuse, but since you guys actually listen to the show, I'm not going to pretend with you that I would have read it had they given it to me. And, you know, pretty much if Don hasn't done a screencast, I don't know how to do anything. I was trying to judge the phone on how intuitive it is. If I have to read the manual to figure it out, I think it's a less optimal device than if I could have figured it out on my own. Note that I didn't judge the G1 if it did something differently than the iPhone, as long as I could figure it out myself. I think people who read manuals have a huge advantage over me in how much they can enjoy their devices, but I simply don't have the patience for it, and I doubt at this point in my life I'm planning on changing anytime soon. So Josh goes on to say, the GPS could have been a reception problem, kind of like all your podcasting cohorts up the coast experience with the phone function of the iPhone. Here in Chicago, I've had no problems with the GPS. When compared with the second-gen iPhones my friends have, the G1 has proven much more accurate. Inside my apartment, when I hit the location button, it zeroes right in on my apartment. My roommate's iPhone puts him in the cemetery across the street. That's not good. Well, I do think I could have done more tests than I did. I felt kind of guilty after I finished doing the review because I was also thinking, well, okay, Steve pointed out to me, I should say, that GPS units aren't supposed to work inside your house. You're supposed to go outside. Maybe that wasn't a good test. Well, as far as the comparison to the iPhone, at least in your example, the iPhone was within the block. The G1 at my house was 10 blocks off and couldn't even make up its mind where to go. Josh's third point. As for the battery issue, the only complaints I've heard about it are from tech critics such as yourself. Actual owners I know don't seem to have a problem with it. Recently, I left the GPS and Wi-Fi on and streamed 2 hours of podcast, took 5 photos, had My Tracks running, a GPS program that records your route to Google Maps, while out for a run with a dog. I played on Twitter for 10 minutes, responded to a half dozen emails, and played a couple of games of chess while shopping with the better half, and actually had about 25 minutes worth of phone calls. Oh yeah, I had Bluetooth on as well for the trip to the mall with the better half. My battery was at 54%. This all started at noon on a Saturday. That night, I did not plug the phone into the charger. I did shut off Bluetooth, though. The next day, I had enough juice to listen to Security Now and run my tracks while walking the dog. When I got back, the battery was at 7% and it was close to 8:45. Either there are some bum batteries out there, or my usage still falls in the lightweight level. Well, I wrote back to Josh and I asked him one more question. I had a theory. Remember I mentioned that the G1 uses a mutant cable, but I've been using a normal mini USB cable to charge it instead. I thought maybe I didn't get good battery life because of that. Here's what Josh sent back. I can attest to the fact that it isn't the mutant cable. I've been using the cable that came with my Canon G9 camera to charge it off my MacBook, and sometimes I use the USB charger from my Motorola Bluetooth speakerphone to charge it from the car and outlet. I think there's just some bad phones out there. I did forget to mention this was my second G1, though. The first one did get a little wacky with the GPS once in a while, sort of shooting around the map before zeroing in on my position. And the battery didn't seem to last as long as this one. The firmware has also been updated twice since I received the new one. I'm sure that has something to do with the difference as well. Well, overall, I thought Josh gave us some really good information, so if you have a G1 and it's not behaving properly, definitely take it back. Hopefully they'll keep doing firmware updates too. I should find out whether the one I used had the firmware updates on it. Well, I mentioned a few weeks ago that the Screen Steps guys had a release version 2.5, but I didn't tell you much about the update. One of the new features is that you can track your lesson status. So let's say you've done a rough draft of the lesson and you want to run it by someone before you publish it, because you're like me and you make a lot of mistakes. Well, you can click on this little gray ball next to the lesson name, and you can switch it to red for not finished, needs more work, or to yellow, which means it needs review, like you're going to send it off to somebody, and finally to green, that means it's ready to be published. If you're working on a complicated project, this can really help you keep track of what you've got left to do. Version 2.5 is also better integrated with Screen Steps Live, their service that lets you do real-time collaboration on manuals, help desk FAQs, that kind of thing, if you're part of a bigger team. I'm going to tell you about more features over the coming weeks. I want to leave you wanting more, of course. But Don, you said you did a screencast on Screen Steps right?
Screen Steps, yes, I did indeed.
A screencast on Screen Steps.
Screencast on Screen Steps. Yeah, they're good guys. I like the developers over there. It's a package I covered quite a while ago, and I know there's been quite a few updates since then. And I have to admit, I need to get myself up to speed on it. But it's a really easy way of preparing. In fact, I have done some real training courses, not just the. The screencast that I do, I actually did some training for a local company and actually used Screen Steps to record the both the information that they could learn from, but also the exercises. I produced the exercises using it as well with screenshots, and it worked really well.
Oh, cool, mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, everybody knows I'm a big fan. So if you haven't tried it yourself, you want to head on over to screensteps.com and download the free 30-day trial. And then when you're hooked like me and Don, be sure to enter the coupon code NOSILLA, which is my name, all capital letters spelled backwards, for a whopping 25% off.
Hi, Allison and fellow NOSILLACast listeners. This is Bruce from North Texas, and this is my review of the GlobalSat BT335 GPS Data Logger. After trying and returning the iFi card, listen to episode 194 for that review, I went in search of an easy-to-use, capable, and compatible GPS tracking logger. I was helped by a very knowledgeable and friendly guy at SimpsonsandCompany.com in Southern California. He helped me narrow down the field to one device that fit my needs at a price that I thought was reasonable. The link to them will be in the show notes. It may be helpful to explain what this device is and why one of these gadgets would be helpful. You use this device to collect data and, quote, tag photos with the location on Earth where they were taken. This is helpful in programs like iPhoto that use this data to place the photos on a map or some web photo sites like SmugMug. GPS is a system consisting of satellites orbiting the Earth, and when a device picks up these signals, it calculates location on the Earth in longitude and latitude. This data is then stored in the EXIF portion of the photo. The device itself is rather small at 2.85 by 1.6 by 1 inches and easily fits in your pocket. Because most things just short of concrete and really thick steel don't interfere with the reception, putting this device in a backpack, photo bag, or purse will work fine. Electronics might interfere, so testing is in order to make sure you're getting what you expect. The device is quite accurate and uses the Surfstar 3 circuitry, which yields better accuracy than other brands of GPS systems. It also has WAIS, and when enabled, it is accurate up to 5 meters. WAIS stands for Wide Area Augmentation System, and there is a link in the show notes for a definition. I found the accuracy to be very good. It has 16 megabit capacity, which is enough to store 60,000 waypoints. The default setting is for it to record the location every 10 seconds. It will also only record new waypoints when the location is changed by more than 16 feet. Both of these settings can be changed in the configuration area. It will power itself down when the battery is drained as well. Operating the unit is quite easy. There's a power button on the front bottom and 3 LED status lights. The top green LED is for battery low. The second green LED is for GPS satellite status, and the third blue LED is for Bluetooth status. Once you turn it on and the satellite LED is steady green, it is recording. There is a power input on the left side, and it connects with both the car charger and the wall charger that are included with the product. The unit is not waterproof or water resistant, so if you're taking it on a boat or think it might get rained on, etc., I would suggest a zippered storage bag to keep it dry. It does have rubber strips on the back at the top and bottom that are soft enough to allow it to sit on the dash of your car or truck and not slide around when the vehicle is making turns or going over rough roads. So you're asking, well, how do you get the data off the device with no USB port? I'm glad you asked. This neat little unit does all of its data transfer via Bluetooth. The range is not more than 20 feet, but that's plenty when you set the device near you to turn it on and download the data. It has another function of the Bluetooth connectivity. The PC software that comes with it will connect and show you real-time location data on a map on the screen of your laptop. There is no Mac version of this provided. The software RouteBuddy does work with this unit, even though the cost of the software is around $100. If you're on the road and want to impress your friends, this is a definite option. I'll get back to the question in a moment, but I want to warn you about a snag you're going to run into. The disk for the Mac is useless other than the manual. You'll need to download the GlobalSync software. If you go to the link I've provided, there is a link to download the software you need, but due to a mistake on GlobalSat's website, you will get the GPS utility, which only shows you the live data, but gives you no access to download the collected data in the device. I had to contact GlobalSat's customer service and have the software emailed to me, and once I installed it, it worked fine. The software is free and tied to their devices. Back to the question. When you turn on the device, you'll need to pair it with your Mac. Once it is paired and you launch the GlobalSync software, you should see the model identification in the drop-down menu. A word of warning. Before you tell the software to connect to the device, make sure the device has had time to boot completely and that the Bluetooth blue LED is flashing and the green satellite LED is either steady or flashing. You click connect, and if you have Growl installed with hardware Growler running, you'll see a confirmation that the Bluetooth connection was made and the name of the device. You have three options in the software: configure, download, and clear. I won't go into the configuration settings because the manual is easy to read and covers all the options in plenty of detail. You can download the data in one of two formats, Google KML or GPX. I use the Howda Geo software, and it requires the GPX format to tag photos. I did make contact with Howda, and they are planning a version in the future of their software that can tag photos in iPhoto instead of having to tag them first and then import them. I'm looking forward to this upgrade. There is no mention of the length of warranty in the user manual, the data sheet, the website page for the device, or the documentation that came with the device that I could find. Lastly, the battery in the unit is a lithium-ion polymer battery that holds 1.6 amp hours, which allows the unit to run continuously for 25 hours. The battery is removable via slide-off cover, and replacement of spare batteries can be purchased for around $10 or used as spares. The model of the battery unit is the same as the unit itself. I bought the unit for $69.95 plus shipping, and they included a freebie, which I could choose from three items: a windshield mount, a carrying case, or a vent mount for $5 extra, and I chose the windshield mount. It's still in the bag, though. Both Glybelsat and Simpsons are in Southern California. I highly recommend the Globalsat BT335 GPS data logger, and especially the use of Simpsons.com store and helpful salespeople. I hope you have enjoyed this review. If you like what you hear, you can follow me on Twitter as Noble Songster. Take care, and talk to you soon.
Well, thanks, Bruce. Really appreciate that you sending that in. Bruce actually sent that in ages ago, and I kept putting it off and putting it off. So glad we finally got around to playing that review. That was great. I still really was hoping that iFi had worked, but I'm glad you gave us another alternative here. So let's see. Next up on the agenda is, Don, I wanted to talk to you about car repair. Talk to me about how cars get... What's it like in Liverpool?
Well, I use a local car mechanic, but it's quite a way away, so I have to take the car down there and leave it off, and then walk all the way back home, wait for it to be repaired, and then walk all the way back down and pick it up, bring it
back.
That
sounds really annoying.
Yeah, I wish I had another alternative. But
is there a better way?
There probably is a better way. Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, what could possibly be a better way than traveling all that way to the to the local mechanic?
What if the mechanic were to come to you?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be amazing? What if he worked on the car in your front driveway?
No. Well, that would be fantastic.
Wouldn't it, of course. Now, if you could only have a Honda or an Acura and you lived here in Southern California, you could have Honda Bob's Mobile Service come to your house and fix your car.
Why can't he go transatlantic? That's the issue. But yeah, and it might even be a reason to come to Southern California, actually.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, just to think to not have to do all that nasty car repair. Well, let's see. Let's tell the listeners, do you have any idea of how you would get a hold of Honda Bob?
Well, you could always call him at 562-531-2321, or you could always mail him at hdabob@aol.com. And by the way, HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
It's time now for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond, only I'm not Alison, and we've switched the Atlantic backwards. So it's me, Bart, and I'm doing a Chit Chat Across the Pond with one of our long-time listeners, Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast fame. So, hi, Donald.
Hello. This is like Chit Chat Across the Pond in reverse.
Yeah, so it's Pond Across the Chit Chat? No. Okay, so we've decided on a couple of topics for today. Alison is afraid we're going to get too geeky, so we're going to have to try to be very good and not get all horribly geeky.
I'll do my best.
I'm going to be the one to try sort of keep everything in check, which is going to work miserably, but hey, we can say we tried.
We at least made the effort.
Exactly. So as tradition would dictate, we're going to kick off with Security Lite. I don't believe there was any major security news this week. I certainly didn't come across any. Did you? Anything pop up on your radar?
Nope, nothing here.
Nothing. I like when that happens. It's not
Me
great
too.
For show content, but it's nice for our peace of mind. But you
exactly.
brought up a topic to talk about here, which I actually, in hindsight, myself and Alison should have talked about this before, because it's become quite a big deal. And do you want to maybe explain the problem?
Well, you know, Leo Laporte says it all the time. Don't click on links that you get, you know, because that's how a lot of bad things spread. Of course, you know, the PC people have to worry about that more because, you know, it's so easy to get infected. But, you know, even us Mac people, you know, a while back there was, for example, that thing that posed as a video plugin. You know, it's like, click, you need to install this plugin to see this video. Well, that was spread by a website. And, of course, you know, we want to avoid that. So, you know, that's fine in email, you know, but a lot of people nowadays use Twitter. And the problem with Twitter is, you know, you've got the, what's it, 100, is it 120? I forget the exact character.
I thought it was 140, the same as an SMS text message.
Right. But anyways, you have a 140 character limit into your messages, so... Some URLs out there are themselves longer than 140 characters, Amazon being notoriously bad at this.
Well, it's not just Amazon, though, because the fashion among blogs is to have the entire title of the post and a bunch of keywords in the URL, which apparently, according to some people, works as search engine optimization. But it results in essays instead of URLs.
Right. So what a lot of Twitter people do is they use these URL shortening services. TinyURL was the first one and still sort of the granddaddy among them all. But now there's a whole bunch of them. Bit.ly, is.gd, quite a few others.
TR.im,
which is TR.im, yeah.
You know, there's hundreds of them.
So the problem is, how do you know what you're clicking on when you're clicking on one of them?
The answer is you don't. And, of course, this... I mean, you say Mac users are safer, but the one thing we're completely not safe from any more than anyone else is phishing. So if we tend to have a trust relationship with the people who we follow on Twitter, we think that they wouldn't dare send us nasty stuff. And I'm quite sure that none of my followers would send me anything nasty intentionally. But as we saw with the recent Twitter worm, not everything that gets sent by the people who you think sent it.
Exactly, because you know it comes from somebody on your that you're following. It's like, oh, this must be, you know, something that Bob wanted me to see. Fortunately, several developers of Twitter clients have solved this problem. Both Tweety, the new Tweety for OS X, as well as the latest version of TweetDeck, now have an option whereby you can dereference tiny URLs when you click on them. And this is fantastic. Unfortunately, they're not enabled by default, which is kind of shame on them. But you know, you have to go into the preferences. And I forget what the exact wording is, but it's something like preview short URLs or something to that effect. When you click on them...
Is the effect then that you see within the post the unshortened URL, or how does it behave?
You still see the shortened URL in the Twitter post, but when you click on it, it'll pop up a little dialog box that gives you the long version.
Ah.
And TweetDeck actually has the better implementation of this, because not only does it show you the long URL, it'll also show you the page title. So you'll see, you know, CNN.com, you know, article name, something like that. But anyways, that's something you might want to be aware of if you're using Twitter.
Yeah, it's actually, this struck me this week as I found myself, now, it wasn't anything actually nasty, it was just a fake BBC website with a fake news story, which was exceptionally convincingly done. But because it came from someone I trusted on Twitter, I clicked on it, it looked like the BBC webpage, and I started reading, assuming it was, and it was only when I got to the second paragraph, and they were talking about the zombie flu, HZN1, that I realized that perhaps this wasn't correct. And then I looked up at the URL bar and realized that it was a completely fake site. But that reminded me how, even though I like to think I'm security aware, even I fell for the trick of trusting stuff that I shouldn't have trusted. I should not have been fooled for a millisecond, but I was.
Right, because it's like, you know, you... On Twitter, you actively select who you want to follow. So it's like, oh, I know this person. You know, it must be okay. But
no, thankfully, this wasn't a bank website or anything, and I probably would, you know, if it was something involving credit cards or money, I'm sure my antennae would have been tweaked a lot quicker. But it's still, I was surprised at myself for not having been more suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, I was exactly the same way. I'm like, wait a minute, you know. But
as I say, so we thought we'd highlight it for people. Be suspicious, ever-present vigilance, as Alison likes to make fun of me for always saying.
Yeah, and if nothing else, do you really want to be Rickrolled again for the 1,000th time?
Yeah, one million was quite enough, thank you.
Exactly.
Okay, so you had a second topic. Now, I'm absolutely intrigued by this topic because I have been telling myself for the last year that I'm going to do this. So you want to talk to us about using Xcode, and are you talking about it in a general OS X context or iPhone or both, or how do you want to go about it?
I want to talk about, you know, I wanted to talk about, you know, we use these Macs, we love our Macs, but there, you know, eventually there comes a point when you say, you know, I want to do more than what this can offer me. So there's the wonderful thing about the Mac is that there are so many ways on the Mac that you can customize it and, you know, program it in essence, much more so than even Linux. I'll start with the least geeky, and then we'll kind of move on from there.
Okay.
Least geeky is Automator. Automator is fantastic. It's a great way of automating common tasks, as the name suggests, and it's really quite intuitive the way it works. You literally snap together little segments of code. Kind of, I call it the sort of the Lego method of building what they call workflows. Is, you know, for example, there, you know, various programs that come with a Mac, you know, Finder, iPhoto, Safari, etc. They export bits of their functionality as Automator actions. So, for example, you know, if you want a common task would be, I've got a folder full of images. I want to, you know, downscale them, you know, so that I can post them on the website. So, you know, you look through the list of Automator actions, like iPhoto or actually Preview. It says, rescale images. So you snap that in. You tell it what to do, and then it's like next action. Mail, open an email document and send the results. So it's like, you know, just with a couple of mouse clicks, you can create a powerful little script, yeah, in other words. That
it's quite surprising how much you can do, because I ended up writing scripts which would take a bunch of folders, zip them up, name them based on the date, connect to a Samba server across the network, copy them over and disconnect from the server. And that was all done by just dragging and dropping and snapping in these little components. So
It's, you know, really fantastic.
You're programming, but at no point in time have you really realized that you're programming, so it doesn't scare people.
Yeah, and if you really want to get, you can even get even geekier in Automator, because there are you can actually call out to shell scripts or Perl code or Python code or anything else if there's something really special that you want to do.
Yeah, I have a bunch of rather geeky Perl scripts for watermarking my images for going on Flickr and stuff and sticking fancy borders on them. So in theory, I could run all that through Automator and have Automator pull the stuff out of Aperture, insert my geeky watermarks using my fancy Perl scripts, and then maybe zip them up and then FTP them somewhere. I mean, there's really no limit to what you can do.
Exactly. Now, say that's not enough for you. The next step up from that would be AppleScript. AppleScript is... It's a scripting language, but it's really easier for humans to read. It's got a more human-like syntax, and
It's about the inverse of Perl, really, isn't it? Because in Perl you have symbols all over the place and the occasional character, whereas here there isn't a curly bracket, there isn't a round bracket, there isn't almost anything. It's just English.
Yeah, it's like,
Finder to do something, you know, literally.
Exactly. And you know, all applications that are Apple scriptable, they have what's called a dictionary in them. So you can, you know, look at the dictionary and see what exact functionality that application exports.
Okay. So how would you find these dictionaries?
So what you do is you run Script Editor.
Okay. Where would we find that now?
I think that's, you need to install, I think, I don't know if that comes as, it might come as the base system. It'll be in the applications directory, or you might need to install.
Hang on, I'm just looking now, because this is an important one. So you're saying it's called, what's its full name? It begins with an
Script Editor.
Okay, maybe I'm going to use good old Spotlight. Script Editor. So, can I tell where that is?
On mine, it's in Applications AppleScript.
Ah, yes, so it is.
So you'd run Script Editor. This is the box where you type in your scripts, and you go into the File menu and click on Open Dictionary. This will present.
Okay, sorry, I'm working along while you. Oh wow.
This will present a list of all Apple scriptable applications on your computer.
Wow,
so, for example,
I'm looking at my list here. This is huge.
Yeah, a lot of Mac software is Apple scriptable. So, for example, you know, you go into Finder.
Wow.
And click on that and click OK.
Okay. And then, I can't even find Finder. There's some. Oh, hang on, there it is. Finder. And then I get to see. I wish I was using a faster machine for this. Look, a pizza wheel. Oh, and then we have categories.
Exactly. Now it'll tell you
and,
every bit of functionality that particular application exports, and it'll give you, like, you know, the basics, how to invoke it, you know, the syntax.
Yeah, this is amazing. Sort of. I'm just looking through here, the amount of stuff, because you have sections and subsections until you finally get down to actual elements in the dictionaries, and each one has documentation for it.
It does. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, I could do with this kind of level of documentation in other programming languages.
Now, Sal Segoyan, he's one of the managers at Apple. He's the AppleScript and Automator guru, and he wrote an excellent book on AppleScript. It's part of the Apple Pro Training series, but don't let that name intimidate you. The book is really well written, and it's very approachable, even, you know, from a novice standpoint. So, you know, that would be a great resource to check out for AppleScript stuff.
And then, of course, to bring it back full circle, if you write yourself a handy little Apple script, you could then use that as an automator action.
Exactly. And if you, and oh, one other thing, there's tons of sites out on the internet where people have posted their Apple scripts. So, you know, one of the best ways to learn something is to learn by example. So, you know, there's tons of places out there you can download, you know, already ready to go scripts and, you know, look at them and take them apart and figure out how they work.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure Visual Hub was basically written as a bunch of Apple scripts.
I believe it was, yes. It calls out to some of the standard encoding tools like FFmpeg and MPlayer.
Yeah, and of course, QuickTime would offer services like that. iTunes would offer conversion of audio.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's really quite amazing how much functionality is offered out to people with Apple scripts. And like you say, it's wonderfully Englishy. So it's sort of the bare minimum of programming you could possibly conceive of doing.
Right.
So what's the next step if we want to go even geekier?
Now, if you really want to get geeky, that's when you want to start programming in Cocoa. The OS X, programming for a GUI, a graphical user interface, has historically been really, really, really hard. Because, historically, if you had to write the code to, you know, throw up a window, manage all the little checkboxes and other fiddly bits on it, that was hard. But...
Which I guess explains why, as a computer science undergraduate, I never ended up programming for GUI. I always ended up programming for the command line. We did four years of computer science, and we never created a GUI.
GUI programming on both Linux and Windows, and it makes your head hurt.
So Windows, you have, what is it you use in Windows? It's some sort of API, Win32, is it?
It used to be Microsoft Foundation classes. Now it's .NET, the C# .NET stuff, which is Shutter.
Okay, not good either. And then on Linux, I guess you have to pick either GNOME or KDE.
Yeah, you have GNOME or KDE, or, you know, just, you know,
plain old X Windows.
Yeah. So it was not easy, and
no point even and click, drag and drop then, no?
No. Even when the Mac first came out, you know, you'd think, oh, it's the Mac, it should be easy. It wasn't. You had to have a special sort of warped brain in order to program for classic Mac OS. One of the things... The classic Mac OS was documented in a series of books called Inside Macintosh, and I think there was like 22 volumes of that or something like that eventually, and each one was about the size and thickness of a dictionary, so you'd know a Mac programmer because they'd have this huge shelf full of Inside Macintosh volumes, and you'd know them because of the way their shoulders slump carrying all of those.
Yeah. So I suppose Macintosh were the first to really provide a GUI. So they may not have, you know, first out of the gate is not necessarily the people with the best solution. Everyone else can sort of learn from classic.
But we have, you know, for the modern Mac OS X, we have Steve Jobs and Next to thank for that. Because
we have the guy who fired Steve Jobs from Apple to thank for that, don't
John
we?
John Sculley.
Yeah, yes. So the Pepsi guy.
Yeah. when Steve Jobs... started Next, he put together an awesome team who created a wonderful operating system called Next Step.
And did they create that from the ground up?
It was based on Carnegie Mellon, the mock macrokernel, and a lot of, you know, BSD.
Okay, but from a GUI point of view, did they really reinvent the GUI from scratch and perhaps learn from the mistakes Apple had made?
Yes, they did. And I had a friend who worked for a science company, a science instruments company, and they outfitted their employees with Next stations. And he went, you know, they trained him. They sent him up to the San Jose or Cupertino or wherever Next was based, you know, to take the developer training class. And he came back and he could not. I mean, he was singing the praises of the Next development environment. And now I know why. It was just extremely easy to put together really sophisticated GUIs. The Next was very popular in financial circles, scientific circles, and the spooks, the NSA, the financial and the scientific people really liked it because they could quickly put together new applications to, you know, to study scientific models that, you know, financial models that change on, you know, on a minute by minute basis. So they could just quickly bang out new pieces of code, you know, to fit whatever situation arises.
So it was really people who couldn't wander down to their local Best Buy and pick up the software they needed because
exactly.
It was constantly evolving and they had to be able to tweak it all the time.
And what, you know, several innovations came about. First of all, NextStep is programmed completely from an object-oriented point of view. And what that means is, classical computer programming, you just have a big old glop of code that, you know, does something. And you know, in some cases, you could reuse that, you know, glop of code to do something else. But usually, that involves, you know, hacking through it and all sorts of complicated stuff. In object-oriented programming, you have the concept of objects, and objects have concepts called like actions and things. So,
I think, you know, probably the simplest description I've ever heard of object orientation, and I wish I could remember who had said it, was that basically the data has all of the functions to apply to that data all grouped as a bundle together. So a window knows how to manipulate a window, and, you know, a button knows how to manipulate a button. And the what and the how are sort of lumped together for, well, objects, for want of a better term.
Exactly. So, for example, you know, like you said, in NextStep, you know, windows are objects, buttons are objects, pick lists are objects, you know, the file open or file save dialog box is an object. Yeah. And so you just basically string all these objects together to create a usable program.
So you say, I'll have one of those, two of those, three of those, put that one there, that one there, that one there, tie this little bit of code into when you click that, tie that little bit of code into when you click that, and theoretically you're done.
Exactly. The next innovation is a fully graphical interface builder. Used to be when you wanted to write a GUI, you know, you'd actually have to write a big glop of code to throw up a window,
or you'd have to do some maths. So, you know, figure out this
exactly.
has to be 4 pixels down and 3 pixels up, and that one has to be 300 pixels down and 2 pixels across, and you end up with these graphs. I've done this. You end up having to count, and this button's so wide, therefore I have to go. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. Whereas what
it's
you'd
ridiculous.
Want to do is take your mouse and go, I want that there. Click, drop.
Right.
Which
but
is
when
what?
Interface builder. Interface builder, yeah. So it's literally, it's like you have this, it's like, kind of like...
Almost like
Adobe.
Stamps in Photoshop or something. You pick the stamp
yeah.
you want and you drop it down.
It's like, okay, you open up your project in Interface Builder. You have a window. It's like, I want a button here. You drag a button out from your palette, slap it there, boom, you're done.
Yeah.
Same thing with, you know, anything else, any other interface element, you know, a checkbox or a, you know, that sort of thing. It's fantastic.
So the only real work you have to do then is to actually write the functionality for the button. So if you have a button that's going to, I don't know, apply some sort of filter to an image, you still have to write the filter. It obviously can't do that for you. But all you have to write is the what.
Right. And in some cases, you may not need to write the filter. I mean,
because there may be a library.
Yes. For example, Core Image is a framework. You know, it's a bunch of objects that basically give you a whole bunch of ways that you can transform and really screw up images. Core Audio is the same way for audio. You know, tons of audio filters and just fantastic.
Powerful here is that when Apple have written these libraries like Core Image, they haven't just written, you know, any old libraries. They've written ones that use the GPU and stuff. So all this really hard programming has all been done for you, and you can write your own image editor that uses your GPU instead of your CPU with very little work.
Exactly. Classic example, Hello World. That's the, you know, the quintessential first program. It basically throws up something that says Hello World. In X Windows, Unix would probably take at least several dozen lines of code.
Which is kind of scary.
On the Mac?
Yeah.
One line of code.
Yay! That's just like it was in the command line. Print hello
exactly.
World. Exactly. Semicolon, you're done.
You want to get a little more complex than that? Your typical, you know, random number game,
mm-hmm.
maybe 5 lines of code. That includes, you know, drawing up all the windows and the checkbox, you know, the button to, you know, to pick the random number and all that stuff.
So how many minutes of work would that be to drag and drop in the various components? 5 minutes?
If that.
Yeah.
It's fantastic what you can do with this stuff. And
okay. So a tool like this sounds really advanced, really cool, really powerful. This must cost a fortune, right?
Nope. Comes free on every Mac. You might have to go on your OS X CD and install it. It's usually in the developer tools folder, but it's all free.
So what do we have to install? Just Xcode, or is there any more we
yes.
can do?
Just Xcode. You'll find the Xcode installer package and just double-click it.
And now, it's an MPKG, so you click next a few times, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, that's programming on the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
When the beautiful thing is, they took most of the Mac functionality and dropped it in the iPhone. So if you know how to program for the Mac, you can do the same thing on the iPhone.
It's the same theory, but the elements you drag and drop are just different elements because they're designed
right.
to be used by your finger instead of by a mouse.
But they work in the same way, in a similar fashion. So, you know, 90% of what you know as a Mac programmer, you can, you know, you're like 90% of the way there to writing an iPhone app.
Yeah, because even you mentioned Core Audio and Core Image and all that, those actual core libraries are all over on the iPhone as well, I believe.
Yes. And now the iPhone, like you said, it's different than a regular Mac. So there are iPhone-specific things, like, for example...
we don't have the concept of a window on the iPhone. We have the concept of a screen.
Right. And like, for example, the iPhone has core location, you know, for the GPS functionality the tilt sensors or, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, that's very well documented. And the documentation for all of the OS X libraries,
yeah.
It's all in there.
In Xcode, very, you mean?
Yes. You go under the help menu, click on documentation. It's all there. It's well indexed. It's all cross-referenced. It's beautiful. It's one of the best documentation packages I've seen in quite a while.
And as well as that, of course, you can sign up for free to Apple Developer Connection.
Yes, for free.
Yeah, if you want the fancy stuff, you have to sign up for a paid account. But you, as a regular casual user, you can get a free one.
Right, and we were talking about the iPhone. You can download the iPhone software development kit for free, and that'll let you make iPhone apps and test them using the software simulator. Now, if you want to actually make an iPhone app for real, you know, just pay your $99, then you can deploy them on real iPhones and sell in the App Store.
So the price of entry to become a millionaire through the App Store is $99?
$9 a year, yeah.
That's pretty sweet.
It is fantastic.
Okay, so let's imagine that all these wonderful tutorials are still not quite enough. How else would you suggest people who have absolutely never programmed in their life, have no idea where to begin, where would they start?
If you're just brand new to programming, probably the best way I would start is, I think Leo's mentioned this before, there's several excellent... there's one called, I believe, Alice, and then there's another one, I forget the name of it. Anyways, they are very good kind of conceptual teachers that teach you the concepts of object-oriented programming, you know, how to string together things to do something. And let's see, I think it's just do a Google search for Alice programming, and you should be able to find it.
Okay. And would you recommend people maybe start with AppleScript before they go into Xcode?
Start with Automator, you know, graduate up to AppleScript. Automator.us is an excellent website for all things Automator. You know, there's some great tutorials there. The MacBreak Dev video podcast, Sal Segoin's been on that a number of times, talking about Automator, and he describes that in a very simple details, you know, very easy to understand.
Great. There's nothing like a podcast, I think, to learn anything. That's just the modern person in me, but if I want to learn something, I dig up a podcast, so that's great to know.
No, I agree, absolutely. And if you want to make the jump to Xcode, one of the best books that I've found, this is the book that I cut my teeth on. It's Cocoa Programming for OS for the Mac by Aaron Hillegrass, if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, I apologize. It's a fantastic book.
Is that an O'Reilly book or not?
No, it's not.
Okay. Because I have an O'Reilly book that I've been meaning to read called something like that, but it's obviously slightly different.
If that's the book I think it is, then that's a good book too.
Oh, that's I've yet to come across a poor book from O'Reilly, which I'm slightly biased on because I may have contributed to one.
And if you don't know C or Objective-C, which is the version of C that OS X uses, an excellent book for that is called Learn Objective-C, and that just basically, it's a soup to nuts book. It takes you from, you know, knowing nothing about programming at all to, you know, being able to crank out Objective-C code. It's a fantastic book.
Well, that sounds like a perfect beginning place, because I've never been in much of a C programmer. So Objective-C has always been a bit of a mystery to me, because I cut my teeth on Java and Perl. And although they look similar, they're not really.
Yeah, there are some differences, but if you already know Java, then I'd just go with the Cocoa Programming book, because, you know, they do a pretty good job of doing the translation.
Great. Okay. That all sounds very good, and we are pretty much bang on our half-hour mark. So we had a third maybe topic, which unfortunately we're going to have to leave until the next time maybe Alison sods off somewhere for the weekend.
There we go.
Thank you very much for your time. Well, it's morning for you. It's evening for me. But thank you for getting up early. I don't know if you'd count it as early, but for me, 10 o'clock is early on a Saturday.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Okay, had a good time.
It was really great. So thank you again. Just remind people where you can be found if they want to look up a little more about you.
Well, I have my website and blog at donaldburr.com, and my podcast, for if you're interested at all in Japanese animation, anime stuff, is otakunopodcast.com, and I'm sure Allison will put that in the show notes. Hang on, I got to go. Someone's at the door.
Perfect timing. Thank you very much, Donald. Okay. Until next time, happy computing.
Well, this is the part in the show where I should make some witty repartee about what the people just said, but I haven't actually gotten a chance to listen to Donald and Bart yet, so I'm looking forward to getting to hear a bit of the show soon. So whatever they talked about it, I'm sure it was fascinating, and I will learn a lot when I get to actually hear the show. Like I said, Steve and Don and I have been off goofing around a little too much. There was one really funny point, and only Donald Burr will really appreciate this. Yeah. We had been traipsing around on the island, and the island of Catalina, and Don looks down, and he had a little bit of a burr, you know, one of those little fuzzy things that comes off of a tree or a branch or something. And he looks down, and he realizes his name's Don, and there's a burr. He was Donald Burr. We thought it was hilarious.
It was funny at the time. And we've also got a photo, though, haven't we, too?
We tried to, but something went wrong.
Oh, that's right, because we used the...
the iPhone and
that great client, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, shut up. No, it was. We fought about Tweety all week long. Well, Don, I got to tell you, it was a lot of fun having you here this week on the show and in our home and in Catalina. I had a great time with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me, Alison. I really probably wouldn't have come across all this way, but Alison was kind enough to invite me to stay at her home and to help me find my way to Catalina. So I went with Steve, and thanks to Steve as well. They've been fantastic hosts, and hopefully I will be back in the not too distant future.
And someday we're going to get over to Ireland and England. It's going to happen.
Yeah, well, when they do come over to the UK, I'm going to have to buy two new cars so that because we never clean our cars, and there's two immaculate cars out on the driveway there that I'm very jealous of.
All right, Don. Well, it was great having you. And again, Steve was probably as much excited about this as I was about you coming out, and had a great time with you. So with that, I'm going to close out the show. Let's see. Make sure you send your emails, especially your dumb questions, to allison@podfeet.com. And don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.